As we come to the end of our study in the book of Esther, a quotation by one writer, I think, puts the book into perspective, and that's this: God is in the throne and is on the throne, and no matter how things appear, it is his purposes that eventually hold sway. We've seen that over and over and over again in the book of Esther. God is on the throne. No matter how things appear, it's his purposes that eventually hold sway. The writer goes on to say, nothing can defeat or frustrate the purposes of God. That is such a comfort for us to understand that no matter how things appear, God's purposes will occur. God will carry out his purposes. God will fulfill his purposes. And nothing can defeat him. Nothing can frustrate him. Nothing can defeat his purposes for our lives. Nothing can frustrate his purposes for our lives. Another writer put it this way: God's hidden providence controls all human behavior. God's hidden providence controls all human behavior in order that his will may prevail even in the godless society of the world. And we're going to talk more about that as we go through chapter 10 this morning, and how God used his people in the godless society of the world, how God uses his people, has used his people through history in the secular governments of the world. I think that's good for us to be reminded about. I think it's good for us to understand this, that God has his people in secular government. And he's carrying out his will even today as he did in the day of Esther. Now, I want to summarize a couple of things about the book of Esther to make sure that I've communicated to you some of the key things about the book of Esther. I want to summarize that. Then we're going to look at the three verses of chapter 10. There are two key theological concepts in the book of Esther that you and I need to understand. The first I've mentioned already several times, and that is the providence of God. The providence of God. That is a key theological concept of the book of Esther. What does that mean? It means that God is at work even in the seeming random events of our lives to bring about his purposes. So I want you to remember, perhaps write it at the beginning of the book of Esther, that one of the key theological issues is that of the providence of God. God is at work in the seemingly random events of our lives. We're not always aware of it. We don't always see it. Sometimes we don't believe it. But God is at work in the seemingly random events of our lives to bring about his purposes. The second key theological concept goes right along with it, and that is God's sovereignty. God is sovereign over everything. God is sovereign and exercises his sovereignty over everyone and everything. Now, the key truth of the book, those are the key theological concepts. The key truth of the book is found in chapter 6 and verse 13, the latter part. I'd like you to turn there so you can underline it. This is the key truth of the book of Esther, and I want to repeat it just in case I didn't emphasize it enough the first time. The key truth is found in chapter 6, verse 13. This is when Mordecai goes back to his family and complains about what has happened and how fearful he has become. And we read, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him and will surely come to ruin. That is the key truth of the book. No one can stand against the Jew. No one can ultimately win over God's people, the Jewish nation. No one can. That's the key truth of this book of Esther. Now, the emotional or key verses of the book of Esther are found in chapter 4. This is where Mordecai has impressed upon Esther that she needs to step up. She needs to intervene with King Xerxes because her people are in dire need. So the key verses, the emotional center of the book, is actually found in chapter 4. Starting at verse 12, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish." That is, God's going to raise up somebody to take care of his people and deliver his people from the difficulties they faced. In this case, it was much more than difficulty, wasn't it? They faced extermination. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Mordecai assures Esther, God elevated her to the position of queen in Persia so that she might have influence upon King Xerxes for her people. God has given you this royal position for a time such as this. And then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish." That section of the book of Esther is the emotional center of the book, the key verses of the book. So the key theological concepts, the providence of God, the sovereignty of God, the key truth is that God takes care of his people, chapter 6, verse 13, and the emotional center or key verses of the book are chapter 4, verses 14 to 16. Now, back in chapter 10, we see, first of all, the extent of the rulership of King Xerxes. And then the second thing we see, the two topics of chapter 10, are the extent of the rule of King Xerxes, and the second is the character of Mordecai. So the book closes with a blurb about the greatness of Xerxes, the extent of his kingdom, the extent of his power, but more importantly than that is the leader that God raised up to be right next to King Xerxes. God had his person right there at the top of secular government. And this isn't the first time that he's done that. We see it over and over and over again in the scripture that God raises up somebody to be right next to the top of secular government. There are so many. I couldn't even deal with all of them this morning, but I do want to talk about three of them. Already we're talking about, or actually four. You include Mordecai and Esther, although chapter 10 only mentions Mordecai. But the two others that I'd like to point out this morning, and we'll talk about in just a moment, are Joseph in Egypt and Daniel in Babylon. In each case, God had his person rise up to be second in a secular kingdom, to be second in influence, to be second in power in a secular kingdom. In a secular kingdom, God is at work. God is at work today, raising up those who belong to him, who will be next to the seats of power across the governments of our world. Perhaps you are one of the people that God is choosing to rise up in our own government. Say, well, politics is a dirty business. Man, it's dirty and getting dirtier, isn't it? It really is. Somebody named it the politics of destruction. I think that's a pretty good name. But I still think there's room for a Christian to rise up. I still think there's room for God to raise somebody up who'll stand next to the powerful people of this world and accomplish His will. It may be you. Maybe you. So I want to look at just a couple and see how God used His people at the highest levels of government. Well, let's look first at King Xerxes chapter 10. There's not much said about him. King Xerxes, verse 1, imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores, and all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king had raised him, are they not written in the book of the annals of the king of Media, kings of Media and Persia? Now, I find it interesting. There is a blurb about Xerxes, but the person that the writer of the book of Esther is really concerned about is the person Mordecai, the power of Mordecai, but more importantly, the character of Mordecai. There's a statement of Xerxes' power throughout the empire. It mentions his imposition of taxation upon the entire empire. And the acts of Xerxes and the account of the greatness of Mordecai are recorded in the official account of the kingdom. Persia grew strong and prosperous under Mordecai's leadership under King Xerxes. That's the point that the writer is trying to make. Now it mentions the greatness of Mordecai and the fact that he is used in a secular government in a mighty way to fulfill God's will. There are two points I want to make about Mordecai, about Joseph, about Daniel, about others that God used at the highest levels of secular government. And the two points are this. Number one, God used His people at the highest levels of secular pagan governments. Whether we're talking about Egypt or Babylon or Persia or other nations, God used His people. God placed His people at the highest levels of pagan secular governments. That's one. Number two is this. The one thing that is common to all that God raised up is this. They were tested. And they went through challenging times. They were faced with life-threatening situations from which God delivered them, reversing the intent of their antagonists. So number one, God raises His people up to be in the highest levels of secular government, pagan secular government. Number two, they were tested, and those He raises up today will be tested. I want to look first at Joseph. Joseph's story is found in the book of Genesis, verses 37 to 50. It would be a great use of your time and my time to spend some time reading Genesis 37 to 50 to see how God used Joseph, to see how God raised up Joseph. Remember, the account of Joseph begins with his dreams, which showed that one day his family, including his parents, would bow down to him. It got him into a lot of trouble, didn't it? Got him into a lot of trouble. His brothers hated him for it. Even his father said to him, "What do you mean, I'm going to bow down to you?" Got him in a lot of trouble. So much so that his brothers wanted to do what? Kill him. But instead, sanity prevailed, and instead of killing him, what did they do? Sold him into slavery. And he found himself in Egypt. In whose house? Good job, Potiphar's house. In Potiphar's house. And you remember the incident there with Potiphar's wife, which landed him where? In prison. Boy, things are going from bad to worse to worse to worse. Right? How would you like to have been Joseph? What happens in prison? He interprets the dreams of a couple of people, Stuart and the baker. The dreams that he interprets, his interpretation comes to pass, and he's eventually remembered, and he is brought to Pharaoh to do what? Interpret his dreams. And his dreams concerned prosperity and famine. And Joseph, because of his wisdom, is taken from prison right to the highest levels of government. Can you believe it? One writer said about Joseph, since recorded in the Handbook of Leadership, God has called us into being and is preparing us for a purpose. In light of this purpose, he sometimes assigns to us courses we would not have chosen as electives. I like that, don't you? God called us into being and is preparing us for a purpose. And in light of that purpose, he sometimes assigned to us courses we would not have chosen as electives. What electives are you going through right now you wouldn't have chosen? If you are, God may be preparing you for amazing things. The process of our preparation, the writer said, often seems slow and painful, but there's no painless way to create servant leaders who possess depth and character. And then the writer of the Handbook to Leadership says this: as a young man, Joseph had dreams that seemed mysterious, but would later be fulfilled in surprising ways. God had raised him up to deliver and provide for his family. But Joseph could never have predicted the torturous path by which the Lord would bring this about. Joseph endured rejection, misunderstanding, persecution. But the Lord was with him through it all. He continued to trust and hope in the Lord, despite the apparent hopelessness of the situation. Through this process of testing and trusting, Joseph was finally ready to take on the task for which he had been chosen. On one remarkable day, I love this sentence, on one remarkable day, Joseph was transformed from prisoner to second in command in Egypt. In the same way, God raised up other servants, in each case a lengthy and sometimes painful process of character and personal development was involved before these people were ready to serve and to lead others. I can't remember at the moment who said it. I believe it may have been Charles Swindoll, who said, God never uses someone greatly until he has hurt them deeply. God never uses someone greatly until he has hurt them deeply. I think that's a tremendous truth of the Bible. Another writer said this about Joseph. When Joseph finally revealed himself to his brothers, this would be in chapter 50, verses 15 to 20, if you want to write that down for your study, Genesis chapter 20. Verses 15 to 20, when Joseph finally revealed himself to his brothers, they were terrified, and rightly so. After all, years ago they had nearly killed him before deciding to sell him into slavery. Somehow, however, much to their amazement, Joseph had become the second most powerful man in Egypt. The brothers recognized that their lives were in Joseph's hands. They cowered before him, trembling and waiting for him to pronounce judgment. This was after their father Jacob passed away, and they thought, surely Joseph has been restraining himself while our father was alive, but now that our father is gone, he's going to unleash the hounds on us for what we did to him. The writer says, instead they heard their long-lost brother speak words of consolation. Joseph told them not to be angry with themselves, for God had sent him to Egypt so that he could preserve his family from the famine that had engulfed the land. Joseph encouraged the brothers to make the reunion complete. by bringing their father Jacob to Egypt, and then later after Jacob died, rather than being vengeful, Joseph was thrilled. Isn't it amazing? He said, God orchestrated this whole episode. By standing back and looking at the big picture, Joseph saw the sovereign hand of God. He realized that God can master terrible situations to benefit his children. Did you hear that? God can master terrible situations to benefit his children. The writer says, what a marvelous, comforting truth. God is in control of your life today. Trusting in that fact today can be the difference between joy and despair. Few truths can change our lives like the knowledge that God is in control. That's what we've been learning. That's what we've been learning in Esther. But it's not just in Esther. It's not just with Esther and Mordecai. It is with others that God raised up to the highest levels of government. Others such as Joseph. Others such as Daniel. Daniel preceded Mordecai and Esther. Babylon preceded Persia. We read many things about Daniel. There's much to study in the book of Daniel, and it's a short book, so it's another one that would be profitable for our study. But the one thing that often stands out to most of us is Daniel where? In the lion's den. I love that passage. That's Daniel chapter 6, and we don't have time to go there, but in Daniel chapter 6, you'll remember Daniel had risen to the highest level under the king in Babylon. He was the most influential person. He was God's person who would not compromise his faith. He was God's person. He had risen second highest in the land. And you remember, I love this about him. The others who he served with hated him because he was so successful and because he did such a good job. And do you remember what they said? He's such a person of integrity. He's such a person who follows the rules, who lives a moral lifestyle, who lives for his God, that the only way we're going to be able to get him is to get him through something that has to do with his religion. And I won't go into all of it. You can read Daniel chapter 6. But the edict goes out that no one can pray to anybody other than the king. You see, they knew that Daniel was such a man of integrity that there was no way they could trap him except if it had to do with his God. Wouldn't that be great if that was said about us? That we were such people of integrity? That to trip us up, to trap us, somebody would have to use our relationship with God. That's what they did. No one could pray. As soon as the edict went out, no one could pray. What did Daniel do? He went and prayed. And the foolish man, I'm being funny, but maybe not funny. You're not laughing, so it probably wasn't funny. I'm trying to be ironic. What Daniel did is he went home and he not only prayed, but he opened his window and prayed loudly. He didn't go home and hide it. He didn't just like, Lord, right now I can't really come to you in full voice. There's a law. No, he prayed in full voice through an open window. And he's sent into the lion's den. There's a lot more to it than that, but the king delayed all day long, not wanting to send him there, realizing that it was for jealousy that he was there. And the king, this is so great to me, Daniel had a peaceful night with the lions, and the king had a sleepless night worrying about Daniel. I don't know what his enemies did. I know what happened to him. They found out what it was like to be lion feed. Daniel wasn't touched. One writer said, Daniel lived faithfully in an environment opposed to faith. And then ask us this question, do people ridicule your Christian faith? Daniel felt it just as much, yet he won respect and never flinched from his duty to obey God first and foremost. Daniel's obedience in a hostile situation began with his diet, extended through his education, and finished with his constant practice of prayer. If you wonder where to start witnessing for God, follow Daniel's example. Honor God by living faithfully in an environment opposed to faith. One writer said about Daniel's prayers, and Daniel has some of the most beautiful prayers, especially toward the end of the book. It's one of my favorite prayers in all of the Bible. About his prayer, one writer said, his prayers were simple, but they were mighty. They reached across the deserts to the ruins of Jerusalem and got to work on restoration. They reached right out of time into the conflict of the unseen world, and they prevailed. It is true that as soon as he had made his evening supplication, he was hustled off and thrown to the hungry lions. But at the hour of prayer next morning, he was back home on his knees again before the open window. He was perhaps a little disheveled and tired after his unusual night, but he was quietly triumphant. You see, he relied upon God. You have to if you really pray. See, if prayer is just relying on our own ability and telling God to strengthen us, that's not good enough. We're going to talk about this in 2 weeks, but prayer is realizing there's nothing I can do before God. There's no power I have. There's no strength I have. There's no wisdom I have. There's no cleverness in me. And I bow before God like that, in that way. Well, God used his people and placed them at the highest levels of secular pagan governments. There are many others. I've just chosen a couple. Each one of them were tested. Each one was tested. Well, verse 3. Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews. Because, now this is the reason he was held in high esteem, not because he had such a prestigious position, not because he had so much power, but they esteemed him because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. He was second in rank to Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, held in high esteem by his fellow Jews, but he worked for the good of his people. One writer said, Mordecai set an example worth following. While Haman was most interested in benefiting from the king's favor, Mordecai was looking out for the king's best interest. Mordecai served the government faithfully for years, bore Haman's hatred and oppression, and risked his life for his people. He was faithful in obscurity. He was faithful in obscurity. F.B. Meyer had something interesting to say about this statement about Mordecai, that he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. F.B. Meyer, great student of the Word of God, said this, "Seeking the good of his people and speaking peace, this epitaph on the life of a simple-minded, true-hearted man might be yours also." And by the way, he's using simple-minded in the sense they would have at the time he wrote, meaning simple, a simple person. Simple minded, true-hearted man might be yours also. Why should you not from this moment adopt these twin characteristics? Go about the world seeking the good of people. It does not always mean that you should give them a tract or a little book. We're always concerned about evangelism. How should I evangelize? And I've got to give them a little tract, or I've got to give them a Gospel of John. Otherwise, I haven't done my job of evangelism. And what F.B. Meyer is saying, maybe just doing good to the people around us is a witness to them. Maybe we don't have to get all uptight about witnessing. Make sure I got the four spiritual laws down. Make sure I know the bridge illustration. Those are good, don't get me wrong. Those are good. The Roman road. Nothing wrong with knowing the Roman road, the four spiritual laws, or the bridge illustration. Those are good. But sometimes we get so uptight because that's where we got to go right away. And maybe like Mordecai, we just have to care for people. Maybe like Mordecai, we just have to have the good of other people at heart. Myers says it's much easier to do this, that is to hand out a booklet or a tract, than to sacrifice your own good in order to seek theirs. You may be quite sure that some little act of self-sacrifice or thoughtfulness for a weary mother or crying child, for a sick friend, or for some person who is always maligning and injuring you would do a great deal in the way of preparing an entrance for the gospel message. Speak peace to people. Soothe agitated and irritated souls. Throw oil on troubled water. There are worried and anxious hearts all around us. A word of sympathy and earnest prayer with them will often remove the heavy load and smooth out the wrinkles of care. Let the law of kindness be on your lips. Do not say sharp or unkind things of the absent, or allow your lips to utter words that will lead to bitterness or wrath. Seek peace and pursue it. That's what he got out of the character of Mordecai. That's what he got. I think that's tremendous. I think that takes the fear out of evangelism, doesn't it? I don't have to be clever enough to answer every question they have for me. By the way, nobody has all the answers. I don't care how long you've gone to seminary. Nobody has all the answers. And if you have the opportunity to be talking with somebody and they ask you something you don't know, just simply say to them, I'll just make it up. No. No. Just simply say, I don't know the answer. That's a really great question. Something I've never thought about. But I know where to find the answer and I'll get back to you. But sometimes we worry a whole lot about it. And maybe we need to be more like Mordecai, working for the good of people and the welfare of people. Well, there's one other thing I'd like to say about Mordecai before we finish. And that is this. He was raised from sitting at the gate, a lowly position, the gate of the palace, up to second in command. There's another test that Mordecai passed, and it's the test of ambition. The test of ambition. You see, many people cannot be promoted and remain unchanged by it. Many people cannot be promoted and remain unchanged by it or let it go to their heads. Many cannot sustain the kind of advancement that Mordecai did and stay centered. In our closing moments, I just want to share with you, there's a great, I'm not going to be able to cover as much as this as I hope because of time, But there's a great chapter in the book Spiritual Leadership by J. Oswald Sanders. J. Oswald Sanders. Spiritual Leadership. It's a classic. Somebody preempted that title and wrote a contemporary book called Spiritual Leadership. Do not get that book. No. It may be a good book. I don't know. But I do know if you're going to choose one, J. Oswald Sanders' Spiritual Leadership is a tremendous book on leadership, and particularly spiritual leadership. And he has a chapter 17, The Searing Tests of Leadership. He mentions five. I wish I had time to go through them all. I don't. I'll just tell you what they are. The five tests, or as he calls, searching tests of leadership, are compromise, the temptation to compromise, the test of compromise. Number two, the one that we're interested in this morning, that of ambition. Number three, the impossible situation. He said the first thing he wants to know about anybody he wants to put in leadership is, have they faced the impossible situation and how did they do? That's a great test. The fourth test is that of failure. What does a person do with failure? I wish we could go through every one of these. The fifth test is that of jealousy. That of jealousy. They are searching tests of leadership. Mordecai passed the test of ambition. Sanders says this, all great leaders face this test, and he used Moses as the example. During Moses' absence on Mount Sinai, the people of Israel turned to idolatry, and God became very angry, saying, I will strike them down with a plague, destroy them. But to Moses, he said, I'll make you into a nation greater and stronger than they. Moses had had it up to here with the people's complaints. Why not accept the divine proposal as a way to give the people their due and start all over again with a smaller group? And yet Moses, not for a moment did the thought, as Sanders says, did the thought of self-aggrandizement enter his lofty mind. He held on to God audaciously and tenaciously. And through prayer, Moses saved the apostate nation from judgment. I recommend the book highly. You can read about the rest of the tests of leadership. Well, to summarize in conclusion to the book of Esther, Dr. John Martin writes this, as the original Jewish readers read this account, they would have been struck by the way God was sovereignly protecting them, often when they did not even know it. Many things in the book of Esther happened that were beyond anyone's control except that of God, who oversees history. And the book of Esther is filled with irony, with ways in which events turned out unexpectedly and in favor of God's people. Queen Vashti, a Persian, was deposed so that Esther, a Jewess, could become queen and save her people. Haman, once exalted, was brought low, and Mordecai and the Jews, once hated, were exalted and honored. A decree that would have wiped out the Jews was overruled by one which led to the destruction of nearly 76,000 enemies of the Jews. No wonder Purim was celebrated yearly with such rejoicing, to help the Jews remember that God is in control and that people should faithfully worship and serve their God. That's the lesson for you and for me. God is in control. We should faithfully worship and serve Him. And I'll close with the words of J. Vernon McGee, God ever stands in the shadows, keeping watch over His own. Let's pray. Father, thank You. Thank You for this wonderful book. Though Your name is never mentioned in it, Your footprints are all over it. Thank You for Esther. Thank You for Mordecai. Thank You for the lessons we have learned and can learn from them. Help us to emulate their faith and their courage and their kindness. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.